No, tell me all about it, Daniel. Tell me about this 18 to 50 fancy pants new lens that you got. You've been making fun of me for all the lenses that I buy. And you're over here buying new cameras and new lenses. Yep.
Well, they go together. You know, you got to have the lens to go with the camera.
Sure.
And I got that camera for traveling. So it's a lens to go along with it. But we've been talking about that Sigma 18 to 50 on this show so many times. And just finally had to see what the fuss was about.
So if the 17 to 70 is the size of like a Stanley water bottle,
which it is. It is basically that size.
Yep. How big, for comparison, is the 18 to 50, the Sigma 18 to 50?
It's hard to think of how to, you know, what you could compare that to that somebody would understand. It's like, you know, those little aluminum cans that are smaller than like a normal soda can.
Like a Red Bull?
Yeah, like a Red Bull. Maybe not as tall as a Red Bull, but like the diameter of a Red Bull.
Do you remember those Kraft tube cheeses that you could get that would melt really easy that they stopped making in like 2005?
No. No, I don't think I ever had that.
Okay, never mind.
Anyway, it's a really small lens. It's much smaller than the 17-70.
It's shockingly small.
Yeah. Well, when I was looking at it, you know, I was trying to decide whether to buy this thing, and I saw that the filter thread size was 55 millimeters, which the 17-70 is 67.
And yeah, it is.
That was kind of what sold me on it, because I knew it was shorter, but I guess I hadn't really considered that it was also, you know, smaller in diameter. And the combination of those two things makes it a much more portable lens.
You can like wrap your whole hand around it.
Yeah. It feels like a Micro Four Third lens when you hold it.
Yeah. It's that small.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me a lot of that the 12 to 50 M Zukunku lens that I had for a while.
Yeah.
I sold to you that was filled with sand.
It is pretty similar to that. I actually, you know, I still have that lens, and I actually looked at it to see what the filter thread on that one was.
52.
And that one's 52.
Nailed it.
Yep. So, you know, pretty similar diameter. And pretty similar length too.
I think it's going to be really good for travel.
I think so too.
It's the same, basically covers the same focal length. 17 to 70 is a little longer,
mm-hmm.
but it's such a different use case because it's not stabilized. Yes, they're both 2.8, but it's so much more travelable. It feels like it would be weird to use it for video.
Yeah, I think so too. I actually had an opportunity to shoot some video on the XH2S since buying that lens. And I still chose to use the 17 to 70 just because of the extra reach, the stabilization. It just made more sense for that type of use. But I mean, yeah, for travel, it's like no question. I definitely want this smaller lens.
Have you taken any pictures with it?
A few, just a couple. The quality looks good. It focuses quickly. I don't really have too many thoughts on it yet, I guess. But I mean, everything I'm seeing so far seems good.
I feel like I also need that lens now.
Yeah. Yep.
But if you bring it, then maybe I can just, well, you're probably only going to bring that lens.
Yeah, I'd probably bring that and the pancake.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So you'd need your own walking around lens.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I was pretty set on bringing the 23.
Mm.
But then I didn't know what else I was going to bring because I was going to bring two lenses.
Yeah.
And I feel bad bringing only primes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but not that bad.
You could maybe talk me into borrowing that if you trade me the 23 on occasion.
Swippy swappy, yeah. Maybe.
I don't know. Something to think about.
My dad's like, Lucas, I have this 24 to 200 f4 to f7.1. Why don't you just get one of those?
Yeah. Well, if you were on a full frame camera, maybe that would be an acceptable aperture.
What's the Fuji equivalent? Isn't it like an 18 to 300?
Is there a lens like that? Is it made by Tamron?
Tamron does make something like that. But Fuji makes Tamron makes the 18 to 300, 3.5 to 6.3 for XF.
That is right up your dad's alley.
Yeah, it is. That thing's about as big as a 17 to 72. I know that Fuji makes an 18 to 120, and that's an F4, but that one's also kind of huge, and it's a power zoom.
Yeah, that doesn't feel like it's made for the same thing. Really.
Oh, here it is. It's the XF 18 to 135.
It's a big range.
Mm-hmm. This one. Oh, and it's a 3.5 to 5.6. It's stabilized. It's $560 new. That I do not want this at all.
I don't think that'd be a good lens.
Hold on. Let me find out what the filter thread is. This is really good radio, Daniel. Just hold tight. Oh, it's got, there's the angle of view. Yeah, that's good. Mm-hmm. Minimal focal distance of 1.5. I don't know why you didn't just get this lens. 67 millimeter front filter thread.
Same as the 1770.
And the 16 millimeter. So respectable. It is 3.8 inches when closed. So it's about the size of like the 56 1.2.
Mm-hmm.
You know, any of those 1.4 primes.
Yeah.
That's kind of not too bad.
I mean, it's not bad on the size, but, you know, I mean, we know primes are better than zoom lenses optically. And I just have to imagine that if you're going to use a zoom lens, having a smaller zoom range is probably going to be better optically than having a huge zoom range.
I'm going to have to find some comparisons. These are almost the same price, Daniel. They're basically the same price.
Which?
The Fujifilm XF 18-135 and the Sigma 18-50.
Well, maybe you should get the other one.
One's like twice as fast. Maybe,
I don't know.
Maybe I should.
I'm happy with the Sigma purchase. I think it's going to be good.
I have to buy different things than you so we can stop having all the same camera equipment.
Yeah, that's probably true. Yeah.
We have like too much groupthink going on over here, Daniel.
We both bought that 17-70. Now we're both going to have the 18-50.
I mean, we also both bought XH2Ss.
That's true.
I feel like part of that was me just like not being able to stop talking about it.
Yep.
And I conformed you into my worldview.
It's honestly worked out pretty well for doing these projects, though.
Oh, because,
yeah, it makes matching colors super easy.
I mean, I got really practiced at matching GH5s to XT3s to Canon EOS Rs, and I'm glad that I'm not doing that anymore.
Yeah. Life is much easier now.
I very much prefer just having two cameras that are the same.
Yep. Even the X-T5 is similar enough that, you know, you can just match them all together.
Yep.
Welcome back to the Camera Gear Podcast. I'm Daniel.
And I'm Lucas.
And we're here today to talk about the gear, software, and techniques we use to shoot photos and video.
Do, 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 do. Bam, bam. Okay, Daniel, the first topic here is your new 18-50.
I think we got that one.
Oh, wait. Okay. I was going to watch some stuff on this before I talked about it today. Are you familiar with the Leica TL2?
I wasn't before I looked at these notes, but I feel like that's the case for every Leica camera because, you know, you mentioned the SL3 recently, and I mean, I think the Leica Q2 is the only camera I've ever seen anybody talk about. I've never seen anything on these other ones. And here you are dredging up more like a camera.
Yeah, at some point, I'm going to really need to stop bringing up point-and-shoot style, small, compact, mirrorless cameras that are either fixed lens or not fixed lens.
But today is not that day.
I keep finding more options. There was a point in time when I said, I mean, it's the, like, what? You're going to buy, like, an X100V or, like, what? Nothing? Because there's no other options. I mean, if you start digging back between, like, 2009 and 2017... there's lots of options, such as the Leica TL2, which you can buy used for somewhere in the $1,000 to $2,600 range.
Which is still pretty high, but
yes,
it's cheaper than it was.
Basically the price of what X100Vs were going for.
Good point.
And it's pretty much the same size.
Interesting.
And it's unibody aluminum, and it looks like Apple made it.
It really does look like Apple made it.
It has a shutter button, I'm pretty sure. But other than that, everything's a touchscreen on this thing, from what I can tell.
Mm, that's a little different than the X100V.
You can slap a tubular lens, electronic eye viewfinder, an EVF. You can slap one of those on the top of it, similar to those Sony, what is it, the ZV-E10? Is that the one?
Maybe. There is one that doesn't have a viewfinder, but you could add it.
This is like that.
Oh.
Big old touchscreen on the back. It's interchangeable lens. It's lens mount. You know, L mount for
L
the
mount.
Lens. Yep.
Interesting.
I said lens mount because that's what the L stands for.
I don't know if that's true.
I also don't know if that's true. Anyway, APS-C, 24 megapixels.
I mean, sounds pretty cool.
I don't know. I mean, there's nothing really super exciting about this, except that it's a Leica. It's got like 32 gigs of built-in storage.
That's handy.
Shoots like 4K video, 7 frames per second, has USB-C, and it's from 2017.
Mm-hmm. And it's got those Leica colors.
It looks super, super clean.
It does. Yeah. It's a distinctive looking camera for sure.
It's very thin and very small.
Yeah.
And if I was looking for a fancy pants Leica walk-around camera, I would probably pick this over a deluxe.
Interesting. I mean, the lack of physical controls is probably a little bit of a bummer, but at least it's unique, right? Like compared to your Fuji stuff.
This one feels a lot more like an accessory than a lot of the other cameras that we've talked about.
Yeah. It's like a fashion statement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would put a rope style camera strap on it.
Yeah, you would. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
For sure. The eyelets for the straps come off, and you have to use what looks like a SIM card ejection tool to pop the eyelets off, and then it has a little cap that can go in the hole so that you can like take them off and then put the cap on so that it looks super, super slim.
I kind of like that, though, because a lot of times I don't use a strap, and I do get annoyed at having those things rattling around.
But imagine where would you put those whenever you're using the strap?
I mean, surely they have a little bespoke case, right?
Maybe like a claw, like a suede bag or something that you can use.
They have to.
What this thing is missing is what they brought in with the Q3, and that's wireless charging.
Mm, that would have been a nice addition for sure.
It sure would. It looks so much like if Apple made a camera.
Yeah.
If Apple made a camera. Except Apple would ship it with 8 gigs and you have to pay $300 to get to the 32.
Absolutely. Yep.
I have nothing else to say about this thing except for I think it's really cool. It's another option to add to the list of sub $2,000 used, like carry around style cameras that you want to put a pancake lens on.
I mean, ultimately, you have so many more options if you're willing to accept something that's like 5 to 7 years old.
Yep.
Because this camera new is way out of the range of what I would want to pay.
Mm-hmm, and I'm sure that the autofocus is garbage.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably as good as your Minolta.
Man, probably. I'm starting to get a hang of that.
Yeah.
You know, most of the last set of pictures that I took with that were in focus.
Most of them.
What I've learned is that I like to take pictures too close.
Well, I think we all knew that was true.
It's just, I'll take out the camera, I go to take the picture, and it's like, I can't get it to give me the little light next to the person or next to the mountain that tells me that it's a close or a far focus.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, I should step back one pace. And I do, and I can take the picture.
Yeah. Maybe you should learn something from that. Don't shove your camera in people's faces.
Well, Danny, I'm just so used to shooting with the 16 mil on the Fuji, because that thing has a minimum focal distance of like 4 inches.
Yep.
I can be as close as I want.
Yep. You can just touch the front of that lens to something and take a picture.
Yeah, well, maybe not that close, but if I put the lens hood on, I can touch the lens hood to something and take a picture, and that's in focus.
Yeah. Can't do that with the Minolta.
We've got some really good dog pics like that.
I bet you have.
I'm just saying, if you're looking for a lens where you can like sit on the floor and just take pictures of dogs and they're coming at you and they're like up in your face, you can still take the picture and it's probably going to be in focus.
Yep. Yep. Not that that ever happens to you, but if it did, the 16 would be the right lens.
I'm just saying, that sounds like a good time.
It does. Yeah.
That's right.
All right.
Okay. I have this other topic here. We talked a little bit about SPAD sensors last week. Yeah, not really.
That didn't go very well, did it?
Yeah. No, I was uninformed / informed. Anyways, what I wrote here is whiffed the topic.
A little bit.
Which I would never admit to. Anyways, so I found a link to an article where Canon talks about what SPAD sensors are, and then they talk about why theirs is super duper baller. It's very like marketing-y.
Yeah, it's a little hard to separate that from the reality of like what actually makes this technology unique, right?
Right. But then I found another link to an article on nature.com where they talk about SPAD sensors used for LiDAR, which are like distance and measuring and that sort of thing, which is one of the main applications for these.
Doesn't your Minolta use LiDAR for the
autofocus? No, it uses IR infrared.
Okay.
Yeah. A little different. Anyway, so LiDAR for like, you know, like to use detection and depth and that sort of determination. And that article is a lot. There are differential equations and integrals and it gets really deep.
You know, I got to say, that's not the type of thing I would expect from nature.com.
Shrug. Like,
doesn't that seem a little out of the pocket?
I'm going to be honest with you, Daniel. I haven't spent a lot of time on nature.com.
I'm just guessing by the name. I mean, I expect to read about giraffes on nature.com, not SPAD sensors.
This is under their scientific report section.
Mm.
And at nature.com, I would expect science stuff.
True. I don't know. It feels like an SEO play. But anyway, let's...
Could be. Do you want me to go to the about page and then read the about page just in detail?
I don't think that would make for good radio.
Okay, not good for that. All right.
Yep.
Well, let's talk about these things. So single photon avalanche diode is what it stands for.
Cool.
And when I read about it, it's just a lot. And so I'm going to simplify it incorrectly and we can all just still not know what this is.
Yeah. But we'll know more about what it is or is not.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Go read the global.canon link and go read the nature link.
Yep.
And then you'll know everything. Anywho, so a CMOS sensor is like, in a way, collecting, like, it's like how much light for a period of time. It's like a volume of light. If you think about a photon, of like a single photon of light having an amount of volume, and then like you have a bucket and you're collecting all of it, and you're seeing like, how much am I collecting over a period of time? And then you're just collecting, you open up the gate to collect anything into that sensor reading area, and you just collect everything. You're going to collect light waves, you're going to collect radiation waves, just everything in the spectrum. And then you're counting up the photon stuff, but you also have a bunch of noise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's we all know what noise is.
Yeah, so that's like a CMOS sensor.
Yeah.
What a SPD sensor does is it counts the photons. So it's not like a volume of light, like how much light I have. It's more of like, okay, I've seen like one photon, two photons, do, and it counts them.
Interesting.
And so it's basically only counting the light. And then Canon's innovation on this involves like mirrors, like I missed my cultural reference. Who's the guy that made the Statue of Liberty disappear?
David Blaine.
But Canon. Canon Blaine. Okay. They use the Statue of Liberty mirrors and something whiz bang, and now it's cool.
Interesting.
But you're basically, what this essentially means though, is that because you're counting the photons and you are essentially collecting no noise, you can use an SPAD sensor in the lowest light possible and get no noise.
It's like they've somehow managed to filter out the light. I mean, I know that may not be actually how it works, but it's like they've managed to filter out everything coming in to only get the photons.
That's a very simplified way to say it. But yeah, you're counting only the light and you're not picking up all the noise. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the advantage of this is like, if you like look out in the distance and you see like heat waves and different things and you're trying to like see things really far, or you're trying to collect light like underwater or measure distance using LIDAR, things where the noise can make it difficult. Using an SPAD sensor gives you the ability to have a lot cleaner of a signal, and also a lot better low light performance. So you can do extremely low light image capture.
Well, that's pretty cool.
And most of the stuff that you're using these kind of sensors for are for very special type of applications. And it's hard to make them in high resolutions. And so Canon's claim to fame here is that they have like a 3.2 megapixel. And they're like, that's full HD. And I'm like, I guess that is true. Full HD is pretty little. It's like 2.3 megapixels. So
oh, man.
Sure.
Kind of works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're just super pumped. They have full HD. But the cool things about SPD sensors are that they can read at like a billionth of a second as far as like time resolution for how long, you know, like a CMOS sensor, you have to have it collecting light for a certain amount of time. Well, for a SPAD sensor, that time is 1 billionth of a second.
Wow.
Okay. And what that means is they can capture video of like light trails.
Oh, like as...
Like if you say, imagine like shooting a laser through a series of mirrors, you can see the laser move. Whoa. If you like shoot it in an interval.
So it's like super high frame rate almost.
Yeah, like crazy high slow-mo kind of thing. Like really, really, really fast sequence of imaging.
That's cool.
But then also you're not having to deal with like the noise of having it, like how much light do I have to have kind of thing, because it can detect, it has that really low light capability.
Man, if they could make these things higher megapixel, then why aren't we just using those?
I think that there's maybe like other reasons, and the spectrum of light and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah,
and maybe demosaicing like the color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's all very much not there.
Yeah.
This is the most advanced SPAD technology, 2023, 3.2 megapixels.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it's a very specialized thing.
Yeah. We're kind of like a ways away. It's similar to what we were talking about last week with all these different, you know, oh, here's this APS-H 250 megapixel sensor. Not really for like photography.
Yeah.
But it is for photography. It's just for a special kind.
Yeah. Because like maybe, I mean, you could obviously take a picture with it, but maybe the skin tones would look horrible, or maybe it can't even cover like the entire visible light spectrum. Like there could be all kinds of reasons that you couldn't actually use this on a camera.
For sure. Yeah. So the speed limit thing, it's capable of capturing like moving objects it was like 300,000 kilometers a second. I think it's like the speed that it can capture.
That sounds pretty fast.
So that's like 7.5 times around the Earth every second, I think is what that math equates to.
Huh. I don't really know how to turn that into, you know, like a usable, like, I don't know how to put that in any context I can actually like understand, but that sounds pretty fast.
It's just a little nuts.
Yeah.
So applications for this are things like the automated driving for vehicles, mm-hmm. like those kind of sensors.
Any kind of LiDAR.
Yeah. So like the LiDAR stuff is really a good application, but anything where you need to be able to detect things very fast,
mm-hmm.
where you don't need a lot of resolution and you need to, you know, cipher out a bunch of noise.
Yeah. Cool. So,
kind of cool. Really interesting technology. Very early stage. I think these things have been around for a little while, but, you know, not in a way that you're necessarily using them for imaging, but Canon has found a way.
Yeah. Well, you know that Canon, always doing weird things and making stuff that's not just normal cameras.
Yep. If only they could make a global sensor.
If only. Burn. Maybe this year.
Anyway, talk to me about this Logitech webcam you're gonna buy.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that. I don't know if I'm gonna buy it, but Logitech came out with a Micro Four Thirds webcam recently. So there were some rumors around this, and I think I saw them on 43rumors.com, you know, which is the Micro Four Thirds rumor site. But yeah, kind of an unusual thing to see, because most webcams have tiny little sensors. You know, there's kind of been a push recently for higher quality webcams. You know, there's a couple of things out there that are $200-$300 that have better quality, but then Logitech says, well, we're just going to make one that has a Micro Four Thirds sensor. And you know, it's for wireless streaming, you know, online, you know, Twitch or whatever, you know, online video stuff. And I was curious to see this thing, but it's $1,000.
Yeah, it is.
And that's pretty high for a webcam.
Does it autofocus?
I think it does have autofocus. It seems like it has a lot of the features that you would like. I mean, I think it might have an HDMI out on it.
Okay.
I know it has USB-C. I mean, so it's clearly made to control from a computer, but I mean, it looks pretty capable as a camera.
Now I've done essentially no looking into this, but isn't it the whole deal with this thing is that you can have a bunch of them. They are able to run on battery for 6 hours while capturing footage.
Mm-hmm.
And you can use the Logitech application to live switch between multiples of these cameras.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's just this Mevo ecosystem they have. And, you know, their idea is like maybe you have two angles on you and then you also have like an overhead cam or whatever. And they kind of imagine like this whole ecosystem, and it sort of feels to me like, you know, what we've done with like Blackmagic ATEM switchers and stuff, yeah. where, you know, you have professional cameras and you're switching broadcast stuff. This kind of seems like the prosumer level of that for, you know, for people that are like really serious about streaming, where, you know, you could buy a couple of these cameras and use their software and, you know, put something together that's a little bit better of a production than just, you know, with one webcam.
I mean, could you suggest that maybe this is more accessible than something like ATEM or using OBD or something like that to bring in a bunch of angles and do all the switching and manage that whole situation? It's like plug and play, and these things can run for 6 hours.
I think that's probably what they're going for. You know, the person that has enough money to spend on something like this, but doesn't want to be, you know, plugging in a bunch of cables and configuring a bunch of stuff, and kind of just wants something that's going to work.
Would you suggest that this is not, while super cool and kind of nerdy, maybe not camera nerd target market?
Yeah, that's what I would say. I don't think, you know, like when I see it, I'm like, well, this sounds cool. You know, Micro Four Thirds. I have some Micro Four Thirds lenses.
Shoot.
I've wanted to use a nicer webcam, and I've previously used a Micro Four Thirds camera as a webcam, but that had some, you know, some problems with the autofocus and stuff. And, you know, like I was interested when I saw it, but yeah, I don't think this product is for people like us.
I think that you could get one of these and you could rig it up as an A cam, and then you could do an overhead cam and then have like two more B cams.
That'd be intense.
Maybe mount them throughout your house, and so that whenever you're on calls, you can just leave your desk.
Yeah, go to other rooms.
And then switch as you're walking through the house.
That sounds extreme.
It would be perfect for a gag.
Yes, it would. If you were one of us and you wanted to get a fancy webcam, a couple of options that may be more appealing than this. One is the Blackmagic Micro Studio G2, which came out. Blackmagic had that big event last year where that guy was standing behind the desk and he kept pulling things out like a QVC show. I think we talked about that on this podcast. But that's a professional Blackmagic studio camera. It's really small, and it's also Micro Four Thirds mount. But, I mean, it's made for doing this type of stuff professionally. So you would need something like an ATEM, or, you know, if you wanted to switch between them, and, you know, you'd have to have a HDMI capture card to actually get it into the computer.
Sure.
But it's the same price. It's also $1,000. And even though this one doesn't have autofocus, I would probably take that over the Logitech thing.
Yeah, so it's the same price, has maybe higher resolution. You're probably going to get better image out of it. It's a more dedicated piece of equipment, but it requires whatever level of accessories in order to then incorporate it into your workflow, whereas the Logitech just takes an app that maybe works, maybe doesn't.
Yep, that's right. And then there's another option that's, I can't pronounce this, but Yongnuo.
Yongnuo.
Yeah. YN433, and that's a Micro Four Thirds webcam. That one comes in at $570, and it looks surprisingly similar to this Logitech one, so much so that people were thinking maybe that's, you know, maybe they're making it for Logitech. It's clearly not the same product, and I doubt it's compatible with Logitech software. But if all you want is a webcam that has a larger sensor and like a real lens mount, then, you know, this is a little over half the price of the Logitech. So that's another option to think about.
What kind of battery does this thing take? Is that like an MPF battery or something?
I can't tell what that is. It may be something similar to that. You know, if I was using it, I would just hardwire it. I don't know why you'd want anything like this to be battery powered, but.
Oh, yeah. I guess it has a USB-C input. So, and then it has another USB. So like it's two USB-C ports, one for power with screws to lock it in, and then one for data.
Yeah.
Or is the power and the data? This is very confusing. Stream and record up to UHD 4K 24. You can't do 30p, mm-hmm. Daniel.
Yeah. Well, you know, for most video things online, I feel like it's still 1080p.
Yeah, I guess that's true. It's always going to downsample it. Mm-hmm. And so you just need the 29.97 1080.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know anything about that one in terms of what the workflow is like or what the quality is like, but so that was interesting.
Supports MTP and it has an Android app for control and live preview. Can't use it with your iPhone, sorry.
Mm.
It is an LPE6 battery, so it's Canon batteries. Any modern Canon battery.
Okay. Well, those are at least easy to come by, and you can get dummy batteries in that. And I mean,
that's true.
You got some options.
All right. This is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Cool for half the price.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would probably buy that over the Logitech if I just wanted to play around with the technology, but.
So when's you had a special order. When's yours coming in?
I did not order one of these. I think if I was going to get a better webcam, which is something I've thought about, I would probably get the Insta360 Link.
Oh.
Which is made by Insta360, obviously, and it's on a gimbal. And so what's cool about that one is, you know, for one thing, if you step back from the computer, it can actually follow you around. Like if you want to walk around the room or something, it can follow you. When you turn it off, it can actually pivot like down or away from you.
Mm-hmm.
So you have kind of like an automatic, you know, privacy shutter type situation. And it also has some cool things for meetings. So like if you wanted to draw on your desk, or, you know, if you had like a notepad on your desk and you wanted to share that in a meeting,
sure.
There's a mode you can put it in where it just tilts down to show the desk. And that's kind of neat. And they also have some stickers that you can get to go with it. That you can stick to a whiteboard on your wall, and then you can tell the camera to go to, like, to find the whiteboard, and it'll find where those stickers are and center up on that.
I've actually been super wanting one of these for a while. They're only $250.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty reasonable. And, you know, I have a remote work job, and it's something I've thought about because I feel like, you know, when you're on video calls a lot, the way you're presented is important. And I've always put a lot of effort into, you know, like my lighting and stuff like that. And I used to use a Micro Four Thirds camera and kind of just stopped because it was annoying.
Sure.
But, you know, I think I think having a quality webcam is pretty important. And something like this, it seems like it could be neat. You know, if you're like trying to like draw out a diagram or something, and you can have it show that.
Essentially gives you those, the iPad features of like it tracking you and that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's Center Stage, I think is what that feature's called.
I've definitely used Center Stage on the iPad for calls.
Really?
If I'm like mobile or if I'm on like a call where it is like, it's okay for me to kind of be around. I'll like set it over there. And I'll be like doing stuff over here. Oh. It just kind of follows me. It's very stupid. I love it. It also looks horrible.
Yeah, because it's having to crop in.
Yep.
So anyway, a couple of interesting options there.
Sweet.
Yep.
Okay.
Is it time for the main topic?
Let's do it.
All right.
We're covering camera companies. Just going through the list. We talked about OM systems, OM digital systems, OM digital solution systems. We talked about Canon.
Yep. We don't need to clarify that one. People have heard of that brand.
Yep. We're talking about Panasonic.
Yep. And Panasonic is also a pretty big brand. They're, are they one of the biggest in terms of, like, out of camera companies we would talk about, with Sony probably being the other one here, I feel like Panasonic has to be, like, have one of the broadest footprints in terms of doing things outside of cameras.
Panasonic is an enormous company.
They are.
They're very, very large.
They make batteries, electronics, like all kinds of things.
Oh, yeah. They make all kinds of stuff. Just so many things. They are not, they're, I feel like to me, they're important for the camera industry, but they're like 5% of the mirrorless interchangeable market.
Which is funny to think about because in my head, they're bigger than that.
Yeah.
But maybe it's because Panasonic is such a huge company. You know, I don't know. But
yeah, I think that it's also a matter of what are they selling and where are their, where's their market? They've been making L-mount full-frame cameras for what, like 5 or 6 years?
I think so.
They were the first mirrorless interchangeable lens camera in 2001. And so they've never made like a DSLR style camera.
Yeah.
They've only ever been mirrorless.
Mm-hmm. Well, before mirrorless, weren't they into cinema cameras?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that, yeah, they had a few cinema cameras. They don't really even make cinema cameras anymore. That's a market that they were in for a little while and then they left.
I think I was thinking about Panavision, but that's not the same company.
That's very different. Okay. Yeah, Panavision's a different company. And so it's I think that Panasonic's such a small part of the market for one, because they were Micro Four Thirds for a long time, and that is has always kind of been a little niche. It's like people who are doing professional are like, I'm just going to shoot on my DSLR. It took Canon another 10 years or more to even come around to doing mirrorless, because you're like, well, you can't see what you're taking a picture of. I gotta be able to look down the lens. And then, you know, Panasonic finally comes around to full frame, you know, let's try to meet the market with what they want.
Yeah, I remember when those cameras came out, you know, in the S1 series was announced, because that's been since you and I were really following this stuff, and I remember when those cameras came out.
Yeah, it's kind of a big deal back then.
It was, yeah.
So state of the union, state of Panasonic, about 5%. I watched an interview where Cine D met with them at the last whatever their last trade show was. I can't remember specifically. It was like 4 weeks ago. And they had an interview with the vice president of Panasonic or the imaging department, and I'm not even gonna try to say his name. It would just be really embarrassing for everybody. Anyway, he's talking about, like, you know, what are we doing and what's Panasonic doing and blah blah blah, and it's like they're focusing on their L-mount alliance. They've partnered heavily with Leica for the last 2 years, and so there's kind of some interesting stuff going on with that partnership. And they're not really looking to do more, like, they're, you know, motion picture perfect is their tagline right now. But it seems like they're not really looking to get into the professional video market. I don't know if we're going to see another Panasonic, you know, ViewSonic camera that's for, is it ViewSonic?
No, ViewSonic's a Sony brand.
What's the Panasonic one?
Cinema camera?
Yeah.
They had something called like the EVA-1 maybe. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Well, it was View something, whatever. It doesn't matter.
I don't know.
I don't think we're going to see something that competes with like the Burano or, you know, a C300 coming out from Panasonic, except for maybe like a little box cam, like a S1H style box cam, because they've been making those for the last few years.
Yeah. Yeah. I could see them. I want them to do that. But I mean, that, even those types of cameras is a clearly a different market from like Burano, you know, or any Venice, you know, professional level cinema cameras.
Yeah. Few interesting things, I guess, kind of watching that and kind of seeing where they think they are and what Panasonic's doing and where they're going.
Yeah.
Obviously, they're splitting their focus between Micro Four Thirds and full frame, which is interesting. There's not too many. I mean, like Sony will do full frame and APS-C. Canon is doing full frame and APS-C.
Well, you got Fuji doing APS-C and medium format.
Yeah.
But so, I think Panasonic is more committed to both than most of these other brands are to both. Like Panasonic has, I would say, like flagship cameras in both sizes. And most of these companies don't.
I would suggest that Fujifilm is maybe the closest with the GFX and the X-mount split.
You might be right. But I mean, I don't know. I feel like Panasonic's full frame stuff is more, I feel like they're putting more into it than Fuji is into the medium format.
Yeah. I am wondering where they're going with Micro Four Thirds. They seem to be pitching it out as, you know, something that can provide more mobility and more speed. And those are, you know, we've talked about that a lot, about what's the advantage of Micro Four Thirds, and it's, you know, speed, and it's, you know, it's small and compact and that sort of thing.
Price too for lenses.
Yeah, and price for lenses. And it seems like those are the things that Panasonic are underlying as well. And that's what they're looking at. And they're like, and look at the G9 too, and it's phase detect autofocus.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's always been kind of hard to figure that out. And we had a lot of these same thoughts with OM systems where, you know, is there really still a place for premium Micro Four Thirds stuff? But for so far, Panasonic still seems like they're doing that. And they're, you know, they're still releasing new stuff in Micro Four Thirds that has, you know, competitive features. And it's still something they're investing in.
I find it interesting how much they're leaning into their Leica partnership. Leica has so much clout in their brand, and apparently the G9 II has a Leica certified, in quotes, monochrome mode. And apparently it was really hard for Panasonic to like meet the standards that Leica wanted them in order to have it be a certified feature.
Huh. Yeah. You have to wonder, are people buying the camera based on that or not? And I don't know.
I think maybe the people who know and care and know how prestigious or I don't know how prestigious, like, yes, Leica and prestige, but I feel like they're very proud of their brand.
Yeah.
And they really don't want to apply their name to something unless it is like the best in their opinion.
I definitely think that's true. And it's always been interesting that Panasonic partnered with them, because a lot of the Micro Four Thirds stuff is really not that expensive, but then you'd always see they had certain lenses that were Leica branded or had Leica in the name, you know, and clearly they were kind of going for like that premium feeling, which is kind of strange to see in Micro Four Thirds.
I think that where these two companies meet in the middle, one, being able to share a mount to compete with Canon and Sony is really good, and being able to bring Sigma into that partnership. I think the L-Mount Alliance is a very good, we're definitely in third place, what can we do to take on the other brands situation?
And that's really worked out well for them, because I feel like when it first came out, I was kind of, like when they came out those full-frame S-series cameras, it felt like L-Mount was kind of a bummer, or it's like, man, I'm just going to have to get an adapter so I can put a normal lens on this thing. But now there's a lot of lenses out there for L-Mount, and I'd be happy to buy into L-Mount.
Yeah, you're going to get whatever you need, and there's some really, really good lenses out there. It's a very complete featured lineup, right? I think that where the partnership with Leica is working out really well is that Panasonic, because of just their scale, have the technology chops to help Leica with the technology of their camera and the processing and the image sensor stuff.
That's probably right.
And Leica has the more of like the art side of this, you know, let's talk about like how we're doing mosaic and what those colors look like and that sort of thing. And so they're kind of complementing each other as far as where maybe they are best experts.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like an art and science partnership type thing.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about their current camera lineup and then what's missing. There's so much stuff that Panasonic has to release, but one of them is the S1R, which I think we've touched on
frequently. Forget that that camera exists,
But something that's interesting to kind of tack off this conversation with Leica is that there's rumor that the SL3 that we talked about a few weeks ago is a partnership camera with Panasonic, and that part of that agreement, this is all rumor and speculation, that part of that agreement is Leica gets to launch it first, and that the Panasonic S1R is going to be an SL3. It's going to literally be an SL3 with Panasonic branding that releases in the latter half of 2024.
So you mean like an S1R Mark II, like that sort of thing?
Yeah, an S1R Mark II will be the same, basically the same camera as an SL3, which kind of makes a lot of sense, because whenever we were looking at the SL3, some of the questions that I had were, who is buying this for video? This thing has a dedicated timecode interface. It shoots 8K 30. It has like all of these crazy video features on top of, you know, the stuff. It's got a CF Express card, but like there's these limits on, you know, the 14-bit read on the 7th. Just, I felt like there was some weird gotchas.
Yeah.
And it's like, why, what is Leica doing? Like, who are they trying to appeal with all these ancillary features? But if you put a Panasonic name, or if you say put Lumix on the front of that camera, and then load up all of the like Panasonic Lumix video feature stuff.
Yeah, all
and,
the
like,
software side.
All of a sudden, it makes a ton of sense.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'd be curious to see how the price, you know, what happens to the price at that point.
I would expect it to be cheaper.
Yeah, I would too. But, you know, just it'd be interesting if it's basically the same camera and then, you know, selling at two different price points from two different manufacturers.
Yeah, for sure. It would, you know. Could be weird, but also I could totally see it.
Yeah.
Because it's the Leica name. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's going to come down to build quality. Like, yeah, sure, it'll be the same camera, but I bet the Leica maybe has maybe some better build quality as far as, you know, what kind of buttons are we using? And sure, it has all the same innards, but like maybe the casing's slightly different or that sort of thing.
That makes sense. I can see that.
How does it deviate? But just, you know, the things that the SL3 shipped with, I mean, it was announced like less than a month ago.
Mm-hmm. We talked about it. Yeah, it's like a episodes ago.
60 megapixel sensor with no low pass filter. Like, it's 8K. It's got 5 stops of IBIS, CF Express. This would be a pretty compelling S1R.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting.
So I'm expecting, if I had to guess, I think that those rumors seem pretty on point.
Yeah, I think it does, that does fill in some blanks.
Yeah, and I would think that, okay, we're probably gonna see an S1R come out later this year.
Yeah.
As far as other things that are in Panasonic's lineup for L mount, they had the S1 series and they had the S5 series.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically it.
Yeah.
They never really went beyond that. They had the S1, S1R, and S1H.
And those are pretty old now, right?
They came out like 2019? 20, no, before that.
2018?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. I think the S1 came out 2018. No, the S1R was the first one that came out.
Mm. So maybe it was 2019 for the others, but even still, that would be 4 years old.
Yeah, they're quite old.
Mm-hmm.
The S5 is the one that Panasonic maybe is the most behind, because not like, oh no, we're behind, but you know, like let's put our support into.
Well, yeah, because they came out the S5 Mark II.
Yeah, I think that the S5 being their $2,000 camera is where they see most of the sales and most of the compromise on performance and price.
Yeah.
And that's where they feel like most of their customer base is.
They're probably right.
It really kind of helps understand why the S5 is the first one that came out with a Mark II and why they're focusing on that lower end before they then go back to the S1, even though the S1 series is older.
I mean, I think they probably made the right call. I mean, as much as I want an S1 Mark II more than an S5 Mark II, the S5 Mark II is a really good camera. And I do think there are a lot of people that, you know, would purchase it at that price point, and then that gets them into Panasonic's world and gets them to see the benefits of Panasonic's cameras that, you know, maybe wouldn't have even considered it if the option was an S1 Mark II at, you know, $3,000, $4,000.
For sure. The S1 series in my notes here says 5 years old, so that would be about 2019-ish. Yeah. And interestingly enough, all the S1 cameras went on clearance like late last year, and now they're basically just special order.
Oh.
You're not going, like, you can't just go out and buy an S1H or an S1.
Well, that's usually a clue that something's coming. Not always, but
a lot of people thought that meant an announcement in early January, and it's
that hasn't happened, obviously.
Yeah, it's like mid early spring, and we still haven't seen anything, and so it feels like imminent. Maybe coming up into NAB in May, that could be potentially where they're going.
NAB is about a month away, so that could happen.
Yeah, I'm dying to see what they do, but
me too.
It's got to be coming, and you know they're really trying to focus on, you know, where can they provide like more range, more value, and they're really trying to sell that they're an open system and we're paying attention to customers. We're adding all these features, and you want time code? Here's time code. Here's a LMAT with a bunch of stuff in it. And we're all this sort of thing, right? They're wanting to come across as the kind of the less closed off brand to everybody.
Well, and I mean, a lot of those things I find really appealing. I mean, they've always had really good video features that give you all the scopes and stuff that you could want. You get time code. I remember like on the GH5, they had all kinds of open gate options and anamorphic D squeeze and things that other brands just weren't doing and still don't have. And yeah, I mean, they feel like the video shooter's camera. Like if you're really into video, then you're going to be really happy with their feature set.
Yeah, it does seem that way a lot for Panasonic. So that's all of their L mount stuff, right? It's not a lot. And right now it really feels like one camera, which is just kind of strange. Micro Four Thirds is still a thing. And it feels like their Micro Four Third line has been shrinking. I would say
it definitely feels that way.
Their full frame line hasn't really felt like it's been shrinking. It's just never felt like it grew out past. I thought that for some reason, I thought there was like an S10 or something. Like they had a third lower tier and they just don't. It's S5 and S1 and that's it.
Yeah.
For their Micro Four Thirds, they had so many cameras.
Yeah, I mean, you had a GX7. I had a GX85. Those were like little rangefinder style Micro Four Thirds cameras.
Right.
They also had ones with more of like a DSLR body, so you could get like a G85 or a G7, like that type of series. And a lot of that stuff has really just gone away.
Yeah, they had the G, the GH, the GX, and then they had like the G100 series for like maybe a smaller, cheaper thing.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we're essentially dwindled down to the G9 when the G9 II came out like late last year. You had the GH6, which is the current GH camera, and that came out in 2022.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came out with the G100D, which is their $500 Micro Four Third, looks like a DSLR with a flippy screen.
Yeah.
And that one's like, okay, it feels weirdly compromised. And that's maybe 1 or 2 years old. And that, like, they got rid of the GX altogether. Yeah. They got rid of the whatever the generic version of the Leica Deluxe is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's gone.
It's funny because I think the G9 Mark II actually has the exact same body as a S5.
Yeah, it's basically the same camera.
And the GH series also is not a small camera. And one thing that's been really interesting to me with their lineup is that they, you know, like that little rangefinder style that was for you and me was our first, modern mirrorless camera. It's interesting that they got rid of that because I do feel like that's a strength of Micro Four Thirds is being small.
Right.
And none of their cameras now are small.
Yeah. That's very, very true. They have, you can get small lenses, but the cameras themselves are, it's essentially the same size as a full frame camera for the G9.
Yeah.
It seems like a lot of what Panasonic is doing is trying to optimize for cost. It's obvious that not a ton of people are buying cameras. I mean, the cameras are becoming more popular again. There was like a dip there for a while where everyone was cutting lines and, you know, trying to reduce their inventory and their product lines. But, you know, from the Micro Four Thirds era with, you know, in the early 2000s, and then, you know, so with cell phones getting really, really good in like 2013, 2015, it just felt like at that point, a huge drop in camera sales. And then everyone's kind of been, you know, trimming the fat as much as possible. And Panasonic here, it's like, let's partner with Leica and so that we can both save on development costs. Let's, you know, invest into a lens ecosystem where we're not the only ones contributing into it, so we don't have to develop as many lenses. Let's use the same body for our Micro Four Third camera as our full frame camera. And just, it feels like they really want to meet the customer where they are, and they're trying really hard on the software and they're making really good cameras, but it's pretty obvious where they're cutting their costs.
Yeah.
And I hope that they keep, you know, at least the money that they're saving, putting that back into the things that we want to see out of them, like a really forward-thinking, innovative GH series, like a GH7 to come out, and an S1H.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It definitely, this has the look of you know, we looked at all of our camera lines and basically cut all the ones that weren't profitable enough, and they've kind of just focused down to a few things.
Yeah. And it just makes more and more sense the more you talk about it. Like the S1R, let Leica run with it for a while. Let's develop it together. Let them have the first cut at all the profits for this type of camera, and then we'll release our version later, and we saved a bunch of money.
Yeah.
Let's put the S5 out first because that's the one that everyone's going to buy because it's the, you know, sub $2,000 camera, blah, blah, blah.
I am really curious to see what they would do with a new GH camera because, you know, I used to have a GH5, and then I changed from that to the XH2S. And one of the problems that I always struggled with on that GH5 was just getting enough light because of that Micro Four Thirds sensor. And I mean, I'm just curious to see if they can actually make something compelling enough to where I wouldn't just prefer to have an S5 Mark II.
One of the advantages of the GH6 right now is that dual gain sensor. It's not something that we're seeing in a lot of cameras right now. And if you're looking for another camera to do it, it's basically the C70. And I'm having trouble thinking of anything else that has that same feature set. And so getting those innovative features down into a lower price point is what they've used that GH line before, getting you know, the high, like 180 frames per second back in 2017 was ridiculous. And so I would love to see in a GH7 like them pushing that dynamic range capability more, because the dual gain where like they read it a high gain, read it a low gain, and give you this really stretched out dynamic range and a lot of extra like lower noise and a really, really good image that competes with full frame as far as, you know, how much dynamic range you can get. I would love to see the limits of that kind of reduce, because you can only do that in certain modes and maybe you're limited in frame rate and that sort of thing. And so being able to see them say, you get dual gain all the time, or, you know, something to that effect.
Yeah.
And then also pushing the speed. You are getting full frame cameras that can shoot 120 frames per second photo. And that's, you know, all pretty much better than a G9 II right now. And so I don't know if they're going to be able to improve on top of that. Even like the stack sensor Olympus cameras aren't at, you know, it's basically the same, right? So unless they went global in a Micro Four Third, I don't think we're going to see anything that fast, but it would be really cool to have the GH7 come out and be like, well, you know, you can do more than 240 frames per second, or maybe you can do like 4K 240 in video.
Yeah, it kind of seems like they're either going to have to push the limits like that, or just really lean into, you know, this is a workhorse camera that's super durable, never going to overheat. Like, this is the kind of thing you take if you need to, you know, film a documentary in the field in like a rough environment. You know, like they could kind of go for that market.
I mean, that was kind of the thing with the GH5 for a really long time, was like, this is the perfect documentary camera. Mm-hmm. It's never going to overheat. It has all the video specs you need. You can shoot in full vlog, and you can throw down some stairs and it'll be fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, then that it was a very solidly built camera. So that's the advantage to that tiny sensor, is that, you know, if you have a normal size, like a bulky big camera, with a tiny little sensor, that gives you a lot of room for thermal headroom as well as just like durability.
Full frame has really closed the gap, especially with global sensors, not global, stack sensors. Mm-hmm. It's closed the gap on these advantages of Micro Four Thirds. And Sony's making these tiny full frame cameras. And it's like, yeah, sure, the lenses are smaller, but, you know, look at these advantages of shooting with a slightly bigger lens. Or maybe not slightly. Those are full frame lenses. I would love to see a GH7 come out that was like, look, this is what full frame is going to be in 3 years.
Yeah.
Like, if you want those features now, this is basically the camera you have to get. It would be really cool to see them do what Canon's doing in the C70 and do what Fuji's doing in the XH2S. And like, I guess it's not the C70 now, but like the rumors of the future C70. Let's see 14-bit readout off of that sensor. I mean, 12-bit on Micro Four Thirds is basically the limit, right? We're not seeing any sort of 14-bit, and mostly because of the size of the sensor. True. But if we could get like a 14-bit readout for video on Micro Four Thirds, that would be pretty stinking cool.
Yeah, it would. Good point.
So I think that there's a lot of hope for what the GH7 could be. And I think that the GH6 sitting there without phase detect basically makes people kind of prefer to pick the G9 II over the GH for a lot of
absolutely.
Stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, and I'm glad you mentioned that too, because I mean, that phase detect was, you know, feels like a inflection point for Panasonic.
Yeah.
Because them not having that was such a detractor from their cameras. And now that they have it and it seems like it's actually pretty good, you know, I think that probably put them back on the map for a lot of people.
It's the kind of thing where you feel like you can't recommend a non-face detect Lumix camera to somebody at this point, sort of. Like, similar to whenever Sony started shipping 10-bit, I was really hesitant to say, go buy like an A6400 for video, because the 8-bit colors are just really not good.
Yeah, well, and once you've seen that new feature, it's like, you know it's coming to the rest of the lineup. And that's kind of why it's been so conspicuous that the S1 cameras haven't been updated yet. Because
it's been almost a year.
Yeah, we know it has to be coming. And there's no way I'd recommend somebody buy one of those S1 cameras right now.
I would in some cases where you can get like a used S1R or used S1 for like $1,200 or $800. If you can get something in that range that's an S1, that's still a decent camera and gets you into a really, really cool lens mount.
Yeah, I guess if it's that and cheap, so, maybe.
Yeah, if it's that cheap and you don't need face detect, the contrast is still pretty good for photo.
Mm-hmm.
That was the whole thing for Panasonic for so long was like, contrast is a better focusing system because it's diffing frames versus face detect will get you 90% there much faster. And then contrast, basically everything's a hybrid system. You have to have the contrast to get you from 90 to 100 and to use that diffing between frames. But if you only have contrast, then you get pulsing because it's diffing every frame. And so then it's changing every frame if you're shooting video. If you're just shooting photo, the contrast is pretty good.
Yeah.
And so, like, I think that the S1 can still maybe make sense if you can find, like, a really good deal on it used, and you're comparing it to something like an R8.
Sure.
But other than that...
Yeah. And for video, it's like, I would just wait until the new stuff comes out.
You can't buy them anyway, right? I mean, basically the only thing you can buy right now is the GH6, G9 II, or an S5.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's got to be coming.
Yeah. As far like that's we've talked about all their lineup. I would be curious to see them come out with maybe another LX100, which is that small little fixed lens camera.
Back on your point and shoot.
Yep. Well, there's rumor that Leica is going to come out with a D-Lux 8.
So if they did, then maybe Panasonic would have the, you know, less fancy version.
Yeah, the DMC. So what we saw was like there was an LX100 and then there was a D-Lux 1, and then subsequently Leica released the D-Lux 2, 3, 4, 5, and then Panasonic released the second D100, and then Leica released the D-Lux 6. So, and they're essentially the same camera. It's just Leica releases a bunch of extra versions.
Yeah.
So it's possible that like the next D-Lux camera is basically the same as the last one.
Sure.
And whatever. I just want more of these compacts. I want. I think that all the camera companies need to just start chasing the X100 6.
Well,
and I'll stop bringing that up.
It'd be interesting. And I mean, the one thing that makes sense to me about that is what I was saying earlier about how they don't really have a GX rangefinder Micro Four Thirds anymore. So, I mean, maybe this could be their compact camera.
I would hope so. Yeah. You know, fingers crossed, that sort of thing. So that's all their cameras right now. That's kind of, you know, where are they going? What are they doing? We've talked about what do they need to release. We've talked a lot about the cameras as far as, you know, GH7, maybe sooner than later, because make sure the GH6 was 2022 and they go typically like 4 years. So maybe we're still thinking 2026 for a GH7, which would be, I think that would be a little crazy. I think we have to see a GH7 this year or next year.
Yeah, 2026 is pretty far away.
Yep. But I think the S1, this is going to be the year of S1. We're going to see more of those L mounts. What else for Panasonic? I have some rumors here that I can kind of run through, but maybe some questions for you.
Well, I mean, obviously lenses, but to me, I just, because they're in the L-mount Alliance, I just don't really, like, I want to see them keep coming out with lenses because their lenses are usually pretty good, but I guess I don't feel like there's any glaring gaps there.
There definitely aren't. I found a link on Panasonic's website, which maybe you want to throw in the show notes, maybe you don't, but they have a chart that shows every zoom for L-mount and every prime lens for L-mount across all the manufacturers, which are Leica, Sigma, and Panasonic. And for a full frame, they basically have zooms that cover 14 millimeter up to 1200 millimeter. And that 1200 millimeter is asterisk. That's a 600 with a 2X converter on it.
Sure, sure.
But they don't have any gaps as far as their zooms from, like, it gets competitive with every brand, right? Canon has some wider lenses, wider zooms, I think. So maybe they're not the widest on the zoom end, but everything from 14 up, like, they got you covered. They have 2.8 versions and like ultra zoom versions and F4 versions. It's very, very full feature.
Well, and it just, since they're not like Canon, you know, holding their own lens mount, not letting anybody else in, there's just so many L mount options. It just doesn't seem like a concern at all.
Right. And if you're looking for prime lenses, because of the Sigma Art series and then Lumix also making, there's tons of 1.4 and 1.8 primes from almost any focal length between 14 millimeter and like 210 millimeters.
They just came out with the lightest 50 millimeter f1.2.
Yeah, that's actually the second 1.2 L mount lens there is. Mm-hmm. There's a 35 1.2 and now there's the 50 1.2.
So there's still a lot of active development happening. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it feels like basically any L mount lens you want to get, you can find.
It does seem like there is a gap on an 85 1.2. There isn't something of that caliber yet for L mount.
I bet it's coming.
Oh, absolutely. With 35 first, I bet that Sigma is going to release an 85 1.2 at some point, and it's probably going to be super duper good.
Yeah, I imagine so.
So fairly complete as far as Panasonic's lens roadmap, because at least they're still releasing lens roadmaps. What they think are planned for this year ish, maybe next year, they want to come out with a large aperture standard zoom. And if you look at their chart, it looks basically like a 28-70. And so I'm thinking they want their own 28-70 f2.
Okay. Sounds fine.
Yeah. I mean, you got one for Canon. You got one for Sony. You know, there's rumors that Canon could be doing a 24-70 f2.
Well, if they don't, nobody else is for RF mount.
I'm just saying, if we can get 24-70 f2s for full frame, where's my 18-50 f2?
Yeah.
For APS-C.
Come on, Sigma. Get on it.
I want that super fast glass. I guess I could just switch to full frame.
I guess you could.
Blech. Blech. Anyway, and then they're talking about an ultra telephoto, something like 100 millimeter 400 plus.
Yeah. Okay.
Which I think there is a 150 to 600, but I don't know if there's a Panasonic 150 to 600.
Mm, yeah, that sounds like a Sigma lens.
Probably what we're going to end up seeing. And so that's essentially it. Those are the two that are on the roadmap. I think that mid-range super fast zoom is probably going to be the most interesting thing.
Yeah. Yep. Sounds good.
Yeah. So as far as other rumors, we talked a lot about the S1R. We haven't really even talked about the S1H at all. But, you know, S1, S1H, I mean, what kind of things do you think maybe we're going to see, or would you like to see in those cameras?
I almost don't want to think about it too much because I really want to see that camera come out, and I could see myself switching to Panasonic for video. So I'm really curious about it. But I mean, the obvious things to me seem like probably a higher megapixel sensor and, I'd have to imagine phase detect.
Phase detect, it feels like it'd be non-starter without the SL3 having the dedicated timecode interface. I would expect then that will be on the S1H.
Yeah.
So really cool. It would be really cool to see a dedicated timecode input.
Mm-hmm.
You know, two thumbs up for that. I want to see built-in NDs.
Yeah, that would be a great feature.
We've started to see that in a few cameras. It seems like it's possible.
Seems like the kind of thing Panasonic would do too.
Yeah, it definitely does. As far as rumors, there's talks of it being like a 34 megapixel stack sensor, which I feel like is a weird in between. You have to hit 40 to get to 8K, and 26-ish is 6K, which we see very frequently. I don't know why you would go to 30 if it's primarily a video camera. I could see 30 megapixels for an S1.
Sure.
But maybe not an S1H.
Yeah. I don't know.
As far as what comes into the S1H, I'm like maybe we see, this feels like an S1R, but maybe we see the 61 megapixel from the A7R IV. I would love to see the 46 megapixel out of the Z8.
Yeah, because that's a stack sensor, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that feels like it would be nicer in a video camera to me.
It's getting kind of long in the tooth, but maybe they can get a discount on it and then go stacked. I feel like it's got to be stacked.
Yeah.
If they did this, what's rumored, this 34 megapixel stacked, I guess, you know, less megapixels, faster read speed, that could be lickety split.
Sure. Yeah, maybe you get a little bit better low light performance or something.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. So other things, ideally, it's got to have a built-in fan. You can get the 5X with a built-in fan, and that's really cool how it's integrated into the viewfinder of the body. The S1H had a built-in fan. Yeah. There's no way that the S1H Mark II doesn't have a built-in fan.
I agree. And so, that's kind of Panasonic's thing, too, is, you know, this camera's not going to overheat on you. You can use it in any environment.
Yeah, a few other possible rumors that people are looking for, maybe like 4K 120 with no crop. That would be pretty nuts. But also, we've seen enough of that spec, especially in stacked sensors, that I would be surprised if it wasn't a headline feature.
Yeah.
So, as far as price, some people are thinking $3,000, but that sounds like a pipe dream. I seriously doubt it's going to be that cheap.
Yeah, I could easily see $4,000. Honestly,
yeah,
for a high end video camera.
Oh yeah, 4,000, 4,500, something like that.
Yep.
Okay.
And obviously, the thing I'm interested in is, are they going to have a box version of it? Because they do for the current S1H.
Man, I would.
That'd be cool.
I would definitely buy the box version if I was going to go that route. It's going to be a pretty cool camera. It's going to be really cool. Just this year.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be this year, right? It
has to be.
We said that last year, and now it really has to be this year.
Definitely has to be this year. All right. So I got a few questions for you here. Does Panasonic need to chase Olympus in the Micro Four Thirds sphere, or can they do their own thing?
I kind of think they just need to do their own thing. I mean, Olympus isn't even around anymore, but, you know, OM system, I mean, it just seems like, I don't know. I feel like Panasonic has carved out its own separate niche as, you know, feature leader and, you know, video centric. And those are things that OM system, you know, I don't think of those things when I think of OM system. So I don't think they should worry about it personally, but
there is a rumor that Sony is developing Micro Four Thirds sensors for smartphone applications.
Interesting.
What do you think that does to the Panasonic Micro Four Thirds market?
I still feel like it's a different use case. I mean, especially seeing the cameras that they have now, if they were still making the little rangefinder GX85, you know, like travel camera, then maybe, but If I'm buying something like a G9 Mark II or a GH6, it's because I'm wanting to shoot photos or videos like in a professional capacity, and I can't see doing that with a smartphone.
Do you think that development and advancement in Micro Four Thirds sensors in the smartphone industry would then have a trickle-down effect to Panasonic? Like if all of a sudden the number of sensors that Sony's producing and developing within that sensor size is now, you know, 50, 100 jillion times more.
I don't know.
It's like if Apple put a Micro Four Thirds sensor in the iPhone, all of a sudden, I mean, then the Panasonic wouldn't be able to buy any from Sony. But, you know, the AI processing and like the computational photography and all this stuff that could be developed around the sensor size and the sensor type, like maybe all of a sudden that is then applicable backwards, that Panasonic can take advantage of that technology stack.
I mean, I think if that happens, then yeah, sure. I don't see why they wouldn't be able to. I'm a little skeptical it's going to happen just because I don't know optically how you get that to work on a smartphone with a sensor that big. And
you gotta look at those Huawei phones, man.
As much as, you know, we joke about wanting it, I don't think there are that many people that want an actual Micro Four Thirds lens mount on their smartphone. And so it just seems, I don't know. It just seems unlikely to me, I guess.
So I don't know if this is necessarily means amount. I think it just means sensor size.
Well, I know. But even then, you know, there's got to be optical physics considerations in terms of what, you know, how much flange distance do you need? What does your lens have to look like? I don't know. It just seems like it'd be hard to get a lens to work with a sensor that big without it taking up like the entire interior size of the phone.
I think you just get some of those David Blaine mirrors we were talking about earlier and you get that problem solved.
I don't know, man. I just don't know.
All right. So one of the things that Panasonic mentioned whenever the S5 came out was that they went with the SSD recording over USB-C because they felt that CF Express was too expensive and they thought that was the right compromise. Whether or not that was like true or hogwash or marketing speak, what do you think about, you know, we're looking at potential S1 cameras coming out. The SL3 already has CF Express in it. If that's the same as S1 already, like it's going to be there, but CF Express or external SSD recording?
I mean, I would love to see the combo slots that Sony has because I understand not everybody wants a CF Express card.
But then you have CF Express A instead of B.
Yeah,
everyone knows B is better. That's what the B stands for, Daniel. It stands for CF Express better. And the A stands for awful. CF Express awful.
I wish my XH2S could record to an SSD. And if it could, there may be situations where I'd use that. But I really like CF Express, and I like having everything just integrated into the camera. I don't have to have an external thing going on. And I didn't think I'd say this, but I think I'd rather have CF Express if I had to pick between the two. I don't know why I would have to. I don't know why I couldn't have both. But if I had to pick, I think I'd pick CF Express.
In theory, I would prefer the SSD because of the cost implications and the ability, like how much storage you can get and all that sort of thing. But in practice, I would be so paranoid about that USB-C cable coming unconnected because of whatever reason and getting my footage like lost or corrupted. Whew. I know that's probably maybe less of something to worry about, but I would be worried about it.
Yeah. I mean, I just, if I'm filming an interview, I wouldn't want to use the SSD unless it was on like a rigged up camera where I've got things clamped down and, you know, and all that kind of thing. And I don't know. CF Express just seems nice. Like you just slide the little card in and it's secure and you don't have to worry about it.
I think there's a lot of friction to external features. Camera companies have been doing, you know, record externally to a Ninja or whatever, Get Raw for a long time. And having CF Express internal really opens up a lot of possibilities for doing things like internal ProRes or internal RAW recording.
Right.
And I think that that makes those features a lot more usable and appealing.
Yeah.
Whenever you don't have to have extra accessories and things attached to your camera and have it like rigged out in order to enable those features.
For sure. I agree.
Am I missing anything on Panasonic?
I don't think so, man. I think we've covered it pretty well. You know, I definitely, one of the brands that I like the most, I mean, in terms of, you know, I've owned Panasonic cameras and I would definitely consider buying one again. I think they have good colors and I just like what they do with their cameras. I feel like they're well built and they have good features. You know, and I want to see them keep expanding these lines. I want to see new S1s this year. And I'm curious what they'll do with Micro Four Thirds, but I don't know. I think they're an interesting brand.
Yeah, I don't think I have too much more to add there. I'm a big Panasonic fan. I've also owned one Panasonic camera. And while we talk a lot about Fuji and Nikon on this podcast, I do think Panasonic's maybe I'm on the top of my list as far as camera brands that I like.
Yeah. Cool.
Cool.
That's it for the show today. Thanks for joining us. And if you liked it, tell a friend so they can check it out too. You can find out more about the show at www.cameragearpodcast.com. And you can find us on Twitter @CameraGearPod. We'll be back with more next week.